welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
And it took a lot of effort for the African Union head of state and government, you know, to undertake advocacy vis-a-vis other countries to get, you know, some of the products down to the continent. So it was extremely difficult.
The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, implements new measures to prepare better for the future.
Where is the official home of the Malawi leader to force him to step down?
An umbrella group plans a nationwide protest next week to call on Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera to keep his campaign promises.
Mahama David Hinks has handpicked all the 1,500 people who participate in the dialogue and who tailor all the outcome of the dialogue to favor him. Then what else would you expect? The only thing you would expect is for them to say, yes, keep on going by holding the power.
And a Chad opposition party calls on the international community to pressure the military junta to hand over power to a civilian transitional government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, says lessons learned from the global coronavirus pandemic and Ebola have led to new measures that have left it better prepared for the future. Officials of the CDC say health diplomacy significantly helped African countries during the outbreak. It comes as African health experts push for the continent to produce vaccines to protect against future pandemics. This as African countries complain that wealthier nations were slow to share access to vaccines to control COVID-19. Dr. Benjamin Judolbai is the head of policy, health, diplomacy, and communication at the Africa CDC. In part one of a Skype interview with me, he talks about the value of diplomacy and the role of the Africa CDC in post-pandemic recovery and in future pandemics.
Health diplomacy is extremely important because it is just the translation of, you know, the way we are conducting diplomacy in the health area. So it is using the soft power of diplomacy to get things done. That is it. A lot of negotiations, for instance, the negotiations around vaccines, the negotiations around, you know, the new pandemic treaties, etc. So health diplomacy is critical, like any other tool we can utilize, you know, to fight pandemics and epidemics.
Would you say health diplomacy worked during the pandemic? Because a lot of African countries expressed concern that they tried everything they could, including purchasing the vaccines that came. You know, everybody was rushing to acquire them. They said they have the money, they didn't get it. So what role did health diplomacy play in that regard?
During the COVID-19, you know, it was very difficult for the COVID, for the health diplomacy to work, especially for our continent, for the obvious reasons. You know, Africa is not a manufacturer of most of the medical products, of vaccines, of therapeutics that we are utilizing, you know, on the continent. And during the COVID-19, we have noticed that many of the countries that were producing these medical products, they close the borders, and you know, they return these products as for their own use. So it was extremely difficult for the continent to access, for instance, face masks, oxygen, etc., since we were not producing. So it was extremely difficult, and it took a lot of effort for the African Union head of state and government, you know, to undertake advocacy vis-a-vis other countries to get, you know, some of the products down to the continent. So it was extremely difficult. I wouldn't say that it did not work. It worked to some extent. And it has, you know, some limitations as well. So that is something that we need to be cautious about.
So what do you think are the major takeaways of this pandemic? Because health experts, including yourself, are expressing concern that we might be experiencing similar ones in the near future.
You are very pessimistic when you are saying that the next epidemic is already around the corner. I'm telling you, it is not something that is far away. It's just that we don't know when or where, but it is around the corner due to multiple factors. But for us, we have learned a lot of lessons. We, first of all, as African continent, we learned the lessons of the Ebola outbreak in 2014-2016, right? And the Ebola outbreak itself fast-tracked the establishment of Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is, you know, medium to long-term tool for the continent to fight, you know, the multiple disease threats that we are facing on the continent. That is the number one. Number two, we have, as continent, we have the Agenda 2063, the Africa we want, with all the agenda to ensure that health, healthy life, and healthy life for the citizens of the continent is ensured. Okay, and the last thing that we have learned for us is that when there is this big crisis, we are on our own. That is why we have come up with what you call the Africa New Public Health Order that lays out, you know, a path for achieving not only the Agenda 2063, but also to achieve our self-reliance and to promote social, economic, and health security. What is the Agenda 20, the New Public Health
Agenda? I was about to ask you that. What is it and how effective do you think that will be?
So for us, one is to strengthen our public health institutions, you know, for people centered care. That is extremely important. That is one. The second is to strengthen, you know, our workforce, health workforce on the continent. For example, if you take cadres like epidemiologists today on the continent, you know, for a continent of 1.2 to 1.3 billion, we need at least one epidemiologist for 200,000 inhabitants. We are far away from that one.
Join us tomorrow for the conclusion of the interview with Dr. Benjamin Judelbai, the head of policy, health, diplomacy, and communication at the Africa CDC. He spoke with me from Gabon's capital, Libreville. In Malawi, Action Against Impunity, an umbrella group that includes civil society groups, is planning a nationwide protest next week to call on President Lazarus Chakwera to keep his campaign promises. The group says it will submit a petition to the president at Kamuzu Palace, the seat of government in the capital Lilongwe. The move, leaders of the umbrella group say, is aimed at pressing the president and his ruling party coalition called the Tonse Alliance to come up with solutions for the socioeconomic challenges facing the country. They say the president has so far not kept his core campaign promise to step down after 2 years if he is not able to resolve entrenched problems, including the fight against institutional corruption. But analysts say demonstrations in Malawi appear to have lost their influence due to the political capital the president and his ruling coalition still maintain. For more on the planned protest, I raised Sylvester Namiwa. He is the executive director of the civil society group called Center for Democracy Economic Development Initiatives.
A number of civil society organizations, including human rights defenders, have teamed up to storm the Kamuzu Palace, where is the official home of the Malawi leader, to force him to step down because, as far as we are concerned, he has failed to live up to the expectation that he's going to fight corruption. Before the court sanctioned June 23, 2020 presidential polls, Malawians reached a consensus that we needed change. And Lazarus Chakwera represented that change that every Malawian badly needed. And he promised to fix this country within 2 years. But today, 2 years down the line, it appears the chief beneficiary of all the high-profile corruption scandals. Because if you begin to follow, you notice that it's either they are emanating from State House or else the president is a chief beneficiary. We have stupid
Do you have proof of these allegations you are making?
Look at this. There is no way that 30 billion Malawi kwacha can grow wings and the president remains unmoved. Recently, the president had to act on a report from the ACB that was submitted to him by the ACB director, Masaji Zuma. He went ahead to act on his own chief of staff and the vice president. The other issue is his own friend and a pastor, Pastor Martin Tom, was involved in the smuggling of loan authorization bill. Another pastor was implicated in the audit of 6.2 billion COVID funds.
But Namiwa, moving or marching to the State House with the plan of forcing the president out, isn't that lawlessness in itself? And will you not be putting the president's life in jeopardy or danger? And will you not be creating instability in Malawi?
This is a president who promised that his kind of leadership is going to be servant leadership. Therefore, there's no way he should be running away from the people he promised to provide leadership. So we are only following his own campaign promises. By the way, we have got a constitutional that says the power to govern derives from the people of Malawi. So all the political leaders, elected leaders, they govern at the pleasure of the masses.
Namiwa, that is true, but the president has a term limit. And until that term limit is expired for elections to be called, constitution allows him a time. If he's unable to do that within the time limit, then you can go to the polls and change him. But going to force your way to where the seat of government is and trying to physically remove him from power and to creating instability, basically fostering a coup, and that is treasonous according to the Malawi constitution.
That is your own opinion. Actually, we are basing our actions on that this is the head of state, he's the president who promised a servant leadership. Now, look here, as I'm talking to you now, it is not clear that we are going to have the AIP, Affordable Input Program. By the way, over 4 million farming families in Malawi entirely depend their life on agriculture. As I'm talking to you now, there are reports that inmates in the country's prisons are starving to death. So, with a combination of the scarcity of forex, fuel, electricity, and now uncertainty over the AIP program, it means the president is condemning millions of the poorest of the poor into early graves because of these issues. We are faced with a number of challenges, but the president is not coming out in the open to give out a clear-cut measure on how he's going to cushion the poor. So in short, Malawi is heading towards destruction. So we want to save this country from destruction beyond recognition.
When is this planned demonstration? When is it?
Thursday, the 27th of October 2022, in Irungu, we are going to hand deliver the petition directly to the president because he has clearly demonstrated that he has failed to use his executive power to bring sanity and to fight corruption. Whatever we're seeing from the president are just mere pure rhetoric and PR stunts. And the president has mastered the art of saying one thing in public and does exactly the opposite in the other side. So we cannot afford to have such a person for a leader because Section 12 of the Republican Constitution is very clear that those people in positions of power are there because of the trust, and there has to be sustained trust. Now, we cannot trust someone who does not live according to his own promises, let alone his own set deadline. So we are calling upon all well-meaning Malawians to join hands to save this country from destruction beyond recognition.
Sylvester Namiwa is the executive director of the civil society group called Center for Democracy Economic Development Initiatives. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
In Zambia, women's groups and activists are expressing concern after a male parliamentarian complained about the clothing worn by the Minister of Health, Sylvia Masebo, during a meeting of the legislature. The complaint forced Masebo to use a scarf to cover her back and shoulders during a legislative session in the capital, Lusaka, on Thursday. Masebo's dress did not fully cover her arms nor her back. This prompted opposition lawmaker Mulenga Fube to criticize the health minister's attire as inappropriate, saying it caused, in his words, psychological noise among her male colleagues. Women's group called his remarks sexist and say that it's not acceptable for men to police the wardrobe of women. Womba Wanki is the executive director at Generation Alive, a prominent movement of young feminists working for the advancement of women's rights in Zambia. She tells me that women are shocked and disappointed by the treatment of the health minister in parliament by her colleague lawmaker.
We are very shocked. I personally am shocked. And I was facilitating a training session for young female politicians. So it actually became a hot discussion in the session because we were talking about, this is 2022, why are men still policing women's clothing? How is that even a topic to be discussed? And if you've watched the video, Peter, she was very shocked. Because of the way he described the dress. So she was looking at herself, she looked at him, and she was wondering what exactly he was talking about. And that's the expression that all of us had. Because you can't win. This just shows us the reality of the fact that no woman is exempt from policing. This is a whole minister of health, a full cabinet minister, but you saw what happened to her in parliament. So what do you think is happening to the ordinary woman or the ordinary young woman or the ordinary female that is walking on the street?
From the reaction, some people are saying Zambian women by nature are conservative, and that by her exposing, so to speak, according to the complaint, her shoulders and her back, which was bare and uncovered, it made some of the members, the male members, uncomfortable with their torturing thoughts. What is your take?
It becomes very worrisome when the honorable members of parliament that we have elected to represent us, instead of focusing on debating in parliament and representing us as citizens or constituents who elected them, decide to spend time having torturous thoughts about a woman who was not even naked. Not that nudity should even elicit any response, but she was covered. They saw a part of her back, and apparently that was enough for them to have those torturous thoughts. We must not sexualize women. We must not police them in any way. And when you talk about being conservative, I think we love using that word very much, conservative and torturous thoughts. When you look at the cases of gender-based violence, especially of a sexual nature, the cases that are being reported by the police every quarter, the cases that are being reported by organizations like the YWCA, the cases that even my organization, Generation Alive, has been receiving from communities. The rapes, the molestation of the girls, the defilements, and all those. When you look at those cases that are happening, at no point does the aspect of modesty come in. At no point does the aspect of being so conservative come in.
Does this mean that women groups, including yours, or advocates for women, would have to educate Zambian men about respecting the rights of women to wear clothes that they feel comfortable wearing instead of being sexualized, so to speak?
We need to triple our efforts. We need to do more in terms of sensitization, in terms of raising awareness. The people that complained and were having torturous thoughts are members of parliament, Peter. These are individuals you would expect would respect a woman's right to bodily autonomy. These are individuals you would expect would not pass such comments. So imagine what the ordinary gentleman out there must be thinking. Imagine what that would trigger. I think it's important that we begin our sensitization or double our efforts, starting with our honorable members of parliament. The right to bodily autonomy is very important. Policing women's bodies, infringing on the right to bodily autonomy, is not right.
So with this happening that you said shocked a lot of Zambian women. Where do you take the issue of advocacy, or where do things go from here?
That's a very good question, because when we are advocating for protection as women, when it comes to gender-based violence, we are advocating to the same policymakers who are having torturous thoughts. So it's about now targeting the members of parliament who understand and respect the rights to bodily autonomy, who understand and respect the fact that women's clothing and bodies should not be policed. That is where we're going to start from. We will engage with them, and these are the ones who are ultimately going to have to engage with their fellow policymakers, and we will also make sure that we express our concerns at the fact that there was such a reaction to Honorable Masebo's dressing.
Wamba Wanki is the executive director at Generation Alive, a prominent women's rights group in Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Chad, the opposition Transformers Party is calling on the international community to pressure the military junta to hand over power to a civilian transitional government that will organize credible elections and a return to constitutional rule. The party says it is clear a majority of the population is against the military government led by interim President Mohamed Idriss Deby Itno, the son of deceased President Idriss Deby. This after widespread condemnation of the violence that left at least 50 pro-democracy demonstrators dead and 300 others injured. The authorities have since imposed a curfew. For the latest political development, I reach Ndolembai Jesada. He is the Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora of the Chadian Opposition Transformers Party.
The people of Chad have unanimously, the vast majority have decided to tell him today, which is the exact end of his 18 months, to hand the power over to civilian so that the civilian can organize a transparent election depending on the timetable that will be set together. Unfortunately, they have used deadly forces against them by killing a lot of them. Meeting a peaceful protest with such a lethal armory shows the desire to hang on to this dynastic power. As I said, this is a modern Wild West in today's democracy that it's happening in Chad. And I call upon the international community to really open up their eyes and look very closely at what is happening in Chad.
A lot of people in Chad that I have spoken with are of the view that if your party refuses to be part of the national dialogue, and a decision has been taken, why then do you go against it by organizing protest against the decision that came out as a result of the national dialogue?
I think the good question to ask is, how was that monologue, I'll call, was put together? If Mohamed Deby himself handpicked all the 1,500 people who participated in the dialogue and who tailored all the outcome of the dialogue to favor him, then what else would you expect? The only thing you would expect is for them to say, yes, keep on going by holding the power. But right before even the dialogue started, we told them we are two camps, some who are pro-Mohamed Deby and some who are called the opposition. So let's go in with a parity team, the pro and the against. Therefore, then we can come into, you choose your 750 people, the opposition team will choose also 750 people, and let's come to the room and discuss frankly. And even prior to coming to the room, we need to decide what topics should we be talking about. Unfortunately, you look when you watch the monologue that had happened, we are not the only one who called for that protest of today. And you can see that it's from all over the place. And yet they tend to say that we are a social media political party, but the outcome of every single protest that we organize or event that we have, hundreds of thousands of people come out.
Indoloba, supporters of the junta are of the view that your party should be held responsible for what happened because you are trying to create tension and to make the military junta unpopular to destabilize the country just so you have a political change so you can come to power. How do you respond to that?
Requesting justice and equality is not destabilizing a running government. We are asking for justice and equality for all. We're asking for running water. We're asking for electricity. We're asking for health centers and educational system for all children. And we're asking for all children to be treated equally. Can you believe that we are 62 years after independence and yet Chad does not have electricity? Access to internet is less than 3%. So,
aren't you trying to force change? Didn't you organize this protest? Because that is what supporters of the military junta are saying, that you are threatening the country's territorial integrity, peace, and stability just so you can score political points and put pressure on the military junta so that the international community would help get rid of them so you can come to power. Isn't that an objective of this?
We are not forcing anything. The Chadian people have decided in the majority that they are not agreeing with what is happening. This is not, we cannot resume that to our single political party. This is a national movement. And if they are in this ideology that it's us only doing this, then they will be surprised. This is happening on the national level. And if they are the men of the world of the military and they keep the word, we will not be at this situation. They should have handed over the power, as they said, by the end of 18 months. And the spokesperson said at the end of the dialogue, said that we are going back to the cavern. It's now up to you civilians to continue the transition. And yet, Muhammad Idris Deby Itno, the general, remains in power.
Does that mean that the protest will stop or you will continue to protest until you said he hands over power to a transitional government to organize elections?
You see, this is what many people are getting it wrong. This is completely out of our hand. It's the people of Chad who is deciding about their future tomorrow. Many of them come out without even being affiliated to our political party because they are, excuse my term, but fed up with what's going on.
Indolembai Njesada is the Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora of the Chadian Opposition Transformers Party. He spoke with me from New York. In Uganda, a leading parliamentary member of the opposition Democratic Party is demanding the immediate resignation of Justice Minister Norbert Mao as president of the group. Lulume Bayiga says the agreement of cooperation recently signed between President Yoweri Museveni and Mao is illegal and undermines the party's constitution. Mao had signed the accord with Museveni a day before he was designated and subsequently confirmed as the Minister for Justice and Constitutional Affairs. Lulume and other members of the parliament from the Democratic Party accused Mao of betraying the top leadership and supporters of the opposition party. Lulume Bayiga, who is also a physician, tells me that the party is petitioning the court to remove Mao as president of the opposition party.
Yeah, he should have done it earlier on, because that is what other people who are migrating from one party to another, that is what they do. First of all, when he took oath of minister, he swore to serve the NRM government, which he has been opposed to. And of course, is bound by collective responsibility of the cabinet, and these are constitutional matters. Collective responsibility of cabinet carries with it agreeing to positions held by the state and held by government. And such positions can even include banning of parties, if at all he's part of cabinet and they say that we are banning these parties or we are curtailing their rights and so on. And that is a position of government. He's held in such a way that he must support.
But Mr. Lulume, some people are suggesting that if the faction or your side say that you have the majority of the people who want the president to resign, of your party to resign, why don't you impeach him if indeed you have the numbers to impeach him instead of calling on him to resign?
We are making this demand because we are even in the Constitutional Court and we are seeking that declaration. Because when he went to serve the government, then he creates a crisis of leadership, being in government and we being in opposition. It creates kind of a crisis because he continues to hold out as a president of the party. And effectively, you cannot continue to be a party which is governed by the party you are opposed to. So we went to court, the Constitutional Court, to seek these interpretations.
But Mr. Lulume, the man has led your party for the last 12 or so years. And some people have said he has led with distinction. And the fact, too, is that he is not the first person of the first leader of DP to cooperate with the government. So at this turn of calling for him to resign really doesn't bode well for how well organized the party should be. What do you say to that?
When Benny Chiwanuka served under Idi Amin as Chief Justice, there were no parties because Amin was a junta. And he opted to serve as a Chief Justice to serve the country, judicial system. So there were no parties. We were not in a multi-party dispensation. When Dr. Samuel Gerere chose to serve in the transition, which was a transition from multipartism through the movement system, then back to multipartism, he didn't serve in a multi-party setting. It was a movement setting, which was also a transition. But in the multi-party dispensation, this constitution we are having does not even recognize a corporation. You can coalesce. It recognizes a coalition. And there are mechanisms of formation of coalition governments. But no corporation has ever been recognized the way that is being held by Mao and Museveni, the so-called cooperation agreement, which was not sanctioned by the party. The Democratic Party has organs which must function any of such activity as sending people into formation or agreement. That's a process, and the process has never been sanctioned. Therefore, there is no outcome that can be acceptable.
So where do you go from here with this call? Now that he said he's a justice minister, he is doing his bit to lead to a transition from President Yoweri Museveni to the next leader of the country. Some people are saying his decision to join the government is a worthwhile that should be supported by the top echelons of or the rank and file of the DP party. So where do you go from here?
President Museveni, who he purports to have sat with and negotiated his way into the NRM, has denied publicly, and I believe you have been reading his Twitter. They have never discussed a transition at all in their negotiation. They didn't talk about transition, and the President Museveni was unequivocal about that. And he has even Mao has shamelessly admitted that they didn't speak about it. Museveni unequivocally has said they never discussed that at all. Then what did they discuss?
Lulume Baiga is a parliamentarian from the opposition Democratic Party. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. With its lush forests, abundant waterfalls, and flamboyant birds, Guinea is the type of tropical paradise that draws tourists. But the West African country has few visitors and earns almost all its foreign revenue from mining, which can damage that environment. Now some are working to change that, as Anika Hamishlag reports from Kindia, Guinea.
Ghanaian tour guide Mohamed Kemara balances precariously on a slippery rock as water gushes around him and the three foreigners he's leading on a hike. Below, the water slices through the cliff, making way for a spectacular view of the forest. He dreams of there one day being a boardwalk that spans the top of the waterfall so his clients don't have to slip and slide to reach the view. But Guinea's government is more focused on developing the country's mining industry than on creating ecotourism projects, he says. When people talk about mines, everyone talks about Guinea, he says. But when people talk about tourism, we don't talk about Guinea. And yet there's a great potential for tourism in this country that could employ more people than mines and bring in much more money, he says. Guinea is the world's second largest producer of bauxite, the primary ore used to produce aluminum. The country is also rich in iron ore deposits, as well as other minerals such as gold and diamonds. Mining comprises about 25% of the country's gross domestic product, yet Guinea remains one of the poorest countries in the world, with more than half the population living below the poverty line. A 2018 report by Human Rights Watch found Guinea's mining industry had destroyed ancestral farmlands, polluted water sources, and blanketed villages and crops in dust. The environmental destruction of bauxite mining can be so severe, it led Malaysia to implement an export ban in 2016. François Kieffer is the operations manager for Belgian development agency Enabel in Guinea. In September, he helped launch an ecotourism project in Kindia, a forested region about 130 kilometers from Conakry, with a high potential to attract tourists. The project is focused on the construction of facilities that make sightseeing more accessible, such as boardwalks and trail signs, as well as the training of tour guides. Kiefer says he hopes the projects will provide an alternative to environmentally destructive practices beyond mining, such as slash-and-burn agriculture and charcoal production.
Aujourd'hui, il y a une pression très très forte sur l'environnement de la part des activités humaines.
He says human activity puts a lot of pressure on the environment, and they realize that it's the local people who are the first victims of these types of activities. The potential for tourism here is incredible, he says. Sites such as the breathtaking Mount Gangan and the pristine swimming holes beneath Khaleesi Falls are largely unknown outside of Guinea. From 2010 to 2017, the country saw an average of just 65,000 tourists per year, 1/16 the number who visited neighboring Senegal. Sekou Kamaha is a local development officer in Guinea's Linsen sub-prefecture. In Kindia, there are a lot of sites that are beloved by the locals, he says. But because those sites aren't developed, people are afraid to go. If we succeed in developing them, Kindia could become attractive, he adds. But for now, people are prioritizing the mines. He motions to the waterfalls plunging down the verdant face of Mount Gangan. That could be Guinea's crown jewel, he says. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Kindia, Guinea.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Health Organization says hundreds of thousands of people in drought-stricken Somalia may die unless the international community acts urgently to prevent the country from falling into famine. VOA Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Health Agency says every single person in Somalia is facing hunger on a scale not seen since the famine in 2011, which killed more than 250,000 people, half of them children. Speaking from the capital Mogadishu, the WHO representative in Somalia, Mamanur Rahman Malik, says every night millions of people are going to sleep hungry. He says half of the country's children, or 1.8 million, face acute severe malnutrition. He warns half of these children may die if they do not receive urgent medical treatment.
I've seen children dying almost every hour in some of the health centers that I visited. Many of them have traveled miles after miles in search of food and water, and their weak bodies just could not make it that last mile.
The WHO reports one out of every 10 children in the country is visiting health centers with diseases that are largely preventable. In addition, Malik says, one out of every 7 Somali children is missing out on life-saving vaccines against killer diseases such as measles, diarrheal diseases, cholera, and acute respiratory infections. This because they and their families are forced to leave their homes in search of food.
We have seen deaths and diseases thrive when hunger and food crises are prolonged. I have visited a number of health centers, which I have seen with my own eyes, how health workers are struggling to deal with the increased influx of children suffering. In one instance, as many as 100 children with severe diseases needed to be cared for by only one or two health workers in very difficult working conditions.
Malik says WHO is working hard to prevent this dire situation from getting worse. He notes the agency is providing health care in hard-to-reach areas and delivering essential medication and other services for nearly 3 million people. But he says this is not enough, given the magnitude of the crisis. He warns many more people will die from disease than from hunger and malnutrition combined unless the world takes action to stave off this impending disaster. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Balake.
Balake.
Kubadili hizo fikra za doto na hofu au wazila ndo vipofu kamili kuwabadili hizo ni njama potofu kika maji wa baridi akiwa ndani ya jokofu nami napima pembe panapo mstari mnyoofu sitaki kula mifupa nataka kula minofu au niweke tenzi nyepesi uelevu uwe mwepesi nipate kiokosi na nasikulizi hii fasiri niondokane na giza nikaziwe mwanga wa kandiri umize kichwa MC sijionekane batiri shika mic kwa dili au tuwe hongo kwa siri hip hop tena kisi tuonekana si msafiri. Nastoi skata maa kweje rap tuweke nadiri kuonyesha kipaji kabiri na ndipo watapokiri.
Wawela mokili na mbango mokili wela na bibi elobama na mikolo ya suka iyo hati kukufes dosa la keba.
Yo wey na mudamu ya mame masale, yo na papa masale.
It's Sheezy. Magic fingers.
Well, upon the time we come up on the arena, you know, say we leave a trace, no bag, I could have take up the area. Had a money bag, boss. Shabba dabba. Money bag, boss. Lie, 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 lie. Sheezy. Come up on the arena, we leave a trace, no bag, I pull out of the game, we have to do it again. Press me button, don't try tell me nothing. Al-Qaeda and Shoki, better more than Mujoku. Don't try press me button, don't try tell me nothing. Didi Galala and Shoki, Shabba Dabba. Positive entertainer, call me the Jagaban, son of the gun. Real McCoy, number one, Ichiban. Make way, lyrical like a pan. Money speaking, bullshit, I feel go. Real bad boy, certify me a wrecker. Step up on stage, me a boss of the speaker. Jack. Guide on me, friends, I forgive all me haters. English, boy not tough, not a distinguished. I love my thing like a satellite dish. I love it when you are wine it like this. Don't try press me button. Don't try tell me nothing. Al-Qaeda and Shoki. Don't try press me button. Don't try tell me nothing. Didi Galala and Shoki. Shabba Dabba. There's no bag, I pull out of the game, we have to do it at the game.
Yeah.
was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nadia Taha, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, death is the key that opens a miser's coffers. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.